Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Sella Cast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, April 9th, 2017, and this is show number 622. I can't tell you how good it is to be back at home. Steve and I had a fantastic time in the Galapagos Islands, hiking Machu Picchu and touring Peru, but there's something about the smell outside of where you live that's just wonderful. Before I get too far into the show, I want to take a moment to thank Alistair and Bart for holding down the fort while we were gone. Alistair's review of using the Apple Watch for swimming was really interesting, especially as we tried it out while snorkeling in the Galapagos Islands. We didn't have much to benchmark around, though, so it wasn't really much of an experiment. But, you know, we wanted the credit. I like the idea of looking through the standard Mac apps, too. That's always a good exercise, and I learned a lot from Alistair. I love Terry Vogelaar's review of Ghost Reader for so many different reasons. That was the application he talked about that allows him to listen to text using the text-to-speech capabilities of Ghost Reader. First of all, what a cool tool. I've tried to use macOS's built-in functionality to read things to me before, and as Terry said, it works great unless you're trying to do long form because it's really hard to stop and start. When I was listening, I was confused by Terry's voice, though, because it almost sounded mechanical, but not quite. Then he confessed he was using Ghost Reader to actually read to us and kind of had a laugh to myself that I thought it was almost mechanical. Maybe it's electrical is the word I want. But anyway, the funniest thing to me was that when I gave a shout out to Terry asking for a review, I was trying to give Terry Austin a hard time. See, he's been promising me a review for at least a year now. Anyway, I'm glad at least a Terry answered the call. I loved Bart's chit-chat across the pond with Dermot Daly from Tapadoo. I'd heard Dermot before on Bart's awesome Let's Talk Apple show before, and I had really enjoyed his contributions. It was really cool to hear from inside a development house, you know, what it's like dealing with Apple and their approval processes. It was great to hear such an optimistic view of things, too. I thought maybe we'd get into like the dark side of, you know, how hard they are or unreasonable Apple is, but it sounds like they're doing a pretty good job from at least from Dermot's perspective. Now, they didn't talk about this, I don't think, or maybe if they did, it was just a little bit. But Dermot is one of the co-founders of an Apple conference called UL, which takes place in Killarney, Ireland. That's right near Bart. I've been planning on tricking Steve into going back to visit Bart in Ireland by using UL as an excuse. Let's see if I can get in, some kind of in there with Dermot. I had known that Bart would do a great job of the NoSillaCast, of course, but that doesn't mean I take his work for granted. I liked hearing his continued analysis about how his tech tools have helped him not just become healthy, but stay healthy. I was poking around in some old photos recently, and I found the shot of Bart and me sitting across a real table at his house, recording the only in-person chit-chat across the pond we've ever done. It was a long time ago, and you would simply not recognize Bart in the photo if you met him today in his new and improved healthy condition. Gotta say, he's an inspiration to everybody. Well, thank you so much, Alistair and Bart. You made my vacation, our vacation, truly relaxing, knowing the NoSella Castaways were in good hands. My goal is not to turn this episode into my summer vacation, and yet there seems to be some interest in the trip. I created two photo albums on Google Photos that are the best of the trip, one for the Galapagos and one for Peru. I'm really pleased with how Google Photos presents the photos and allows me to do pretty close to full resolution for free. Since I'm purposely sharing these photos with the world, I have no privacy concerns about what they do with my data, so it's all good. I did a little blog post about the two albums, so you can head over to see them if you like. This is not mandatory viewing, by the way. It will not be on the final exam. I'll also be doing a segment in a few minutes all about using tech and travel for the trip to South America. Sort of a hodgepodge of, what worked and what didn't. You may have noticed that there was no chit-chat across the pond this week, as Bart has been under the weather. So next week will be a new Programming by Stealth episode. After a really long tease, he's finally going to teach us about test-driven development, otherwise known as TDD. The idea to talk about test-driven development came up because listener Jill brought it up ages ago. She's been kind of teaching me some stuff on the side that I've been using. Then Bart started studying it, and he's a convert now. I'm really looking forward to it because, like I said, I've been doing a little bit of it, but definitely not with the full rigor that I think we're going to learn. We got home from the trip on a Tuesday, and I found an email from Dan Morin of Relay.fm asking if I'd be on Clockwise the next morning. It was madness to agree, but since the most awesome Micah Sargent was going to be on, and we have an ironclad contract that if one of us is on, the other one has to be on, I said yes. It was a super fun episode. We talked about Apple and the new focus on the pro market. We discussed the lifetime of our gadgets, and I managed to work in a discussion on how much tech you should bring on vacation. Oh, and Lex Fridman was on it too, and I'd never, quote unquote, met him before. Haven't met lots of these people in person, but anyway, I'd never met him before, and that was super fun. Check out the episode at relay.fm/clockwise and look for episode number 183. Well, that wasn't enough podcasting for the week. Bart was feeling under the weather, like I mentioned. And so I offered, you know, you want me to jump on Let's Talk Apple with you to help carry the energy so he didn't have to? Well, I was kind of surprised at how energetic he was on the show. I don't think he needed my help at all. But it was great fun to chat with Gazmaz and Nick Riley, who I also haven't, quote unquote, met before. Anyway, we talked about this last month's Apple news. It was extra fun for me because the news was pretty much all new to me. Since I've been on vacation, right? Anyway, check it out. Let's-talk.ie, episode number 43. You know, for a big trip to South America, going to the Galapagos and Islands in Ecuador and the hike to Machu Picchu in Peru, being geeks, we brought an enormous amount of tech with us. And, you know, we used just about every bit of it. We thought it might be interesting to talk through what worked well on a trip like this and give a few anecdotes of tech fun along the way. Probably the single best thing we did was get the Project Fi card. In an article back in March, I explained that Project Fi is a data SIM you can get from Google and then put it into an iPhone to get data internationally in 135 countries. I explained in the article how you got to buy a Google phone first, and that's an extensive story that explains how it works. But anyway, we got one card with a phone number and data and a second data-only SIM that shared the same plan. So we didn't have to do any kind of shenanigans of saying, okay, you get 1 gigabyte, I get 2 gigabytes, and somebody has some left over, somebody else doesn't have it. It's all one shared data plan, which is really cool. Like I said, there's a lot of details I won't go into again, but the bottom line is, on this trip, we had data for only $10 a gigabyte. I have to say that it easily met, if not exceeded, our expectations. We had LTE data in all of the major cities like Quito in Ecuador and then Lima and Cusco in Peru. We often had 3G access when we were in really remote areas. We even had 3G access on the top of the mountain climbing in Machu Picchu, which is an ancient Incan city. So in picture Steve at the top of the mountain, he sent him pictures to Facebook from the top of the mountain. When we were on the boat in the Galapagos, there were only a few days there where there was no data, but you know what? Nobody else had any data either. We played around on Facebook, like I said. Steve was uploading photos and even some small videos, and I wrote my travelogue full of photos that I send every day out to our friends and family whenever we go on these extensive vacations. We kept the images pretty small, using photos to export them to 400 pixels wide, you know, just to save bandwidth. We tried not to watch any video at all, but I got to tell you, if a video of Forbes came in from Lindsay, you know we watched it. We used a total of 6.22 gigabytes, which cost us $62.20 since Google charges it linearly, and then plus the monthly fee of $20. So for 3 weeks of, you know, a lot of usage, I mean, we did maps and everything, we spent a total of $82.20. Project Fi was a total success. You're going to hear more about why it was so important, beyond the Forbes videos, later in this article. On the boat to the Galapagos Islands, they had an Apple TV so they could show us maps of the islands where we were going to land and explanations of what we were going to see. I noticed early on that whenever they weren't presenting on the Apple TV, it was showing a gorgeous slideshow of animals like sea lions, iguanas, turtles, and the famous blue-footed boobies. That's what they're actually called, and yes, it is really fun to say. However, there was a big black box covering part of the screensaver explaining the Wi-Fi SSID to which you should connect if you wanted to connect to the Apple TV. I told our naturalist Pepe that I could probably fix it if I could get a hold of the remote. I'd done a quick search online to find out this is a feature called conference room mode, and it just needed to be switched off. Figured I'd be a hero. Anyway, he got me the remote, but there was one little obstacle. The menus were all in Spanish. I grabbed our new friend Miles, who's British but speaks a lot of languages, including a little bit of Spanish. We poked around quite a bit, but the conversational Spanish he used to order dinner and ask the time is quite a bit different than technical Spanish. Finally, Miles found a menu that said Idioma, which is Spanish for language. We flipped it to English, and I found the conference room mode, turned it off, and we put the Idioma back to Spanish. I was very proud of myself, but pretty much nobody else seemed that impressed. Yeah, well. Well, the second tech support story is much more fun. On the Peruvian part of our trip, our guide was a lovely young man named Nick. He had just converted from an Android phone to the iPhone right before he met us. He was quite proud of the fact that he had an iPhone 7 Plus because they're actually not available yet in Peru. He bought his while he was on a recent trip to the United States. Anyway, since he was new to the platform, he really wanted to know every trick I could teach him on the iPhone. Since he was responsible for my well-being, including a hike at 12,000 feet, luckily a mostly downhill hike, and the very strenuous Machu Picchu hike, which goes up 2,000 feet in 2 miles, I decided a trade was in order. I told him for every mile I didn't fall down, he would get another tip. Sometimes he'd tell me the tip wasn't good enough and I'd have to pull out a better one. So the day we went to Machu Picchu included an hour-long train ride. I was showing him the magnifier function on the iPhone, and suddenly the two women across the aisle from us that we didn't know said, wait, slow down. We go into settings, general, accessibility, and then what do we do next? Basically, we found our tribe. Joanne was the geekiest. I only noticed after we were chatting for a bit that she was actually wearing AirPods, but Mary loved the iPhone too. They're both flight attendants for United, and they were on vacation with some of their other flight attendant friends. After we finished the hike, that's Nick, Steve, and me, I dragged Nick out to a bar for some beers. Hey, I earned those beers. I don't want to hear anything from you guys. Anyway, we were well into the second round, and who should walk by but Joanne and Mary? They had their other friends with us, the other flight attendants, and they joined us at our table. One of the guys, his name is Griffin, he's a hardcore gadget guy. He was super entertaining as he talked about his quest for a new Micro Four Thirds camera. I told him that he definitely needs to be on the podcast someday soon, and he agreed. Steve and I both wore our Apple Watches for the entire trip and discovered two interesting things. The first had to do with what workout to choose when hiking. We were curious whether we should choose outdoor walk, which would make sense, or stair climber, because we were climbing a lot of stairs. I wanted outdoor walk because it would show distance, and stair climber doesn't, but Steve noticed that he got way more calories burned if he chose stair climber. Which do you think he chose from then on? Well, at one point in the trip, I was left alone while he was off doing something, and he couldn't have his Apple Watch with him. I'll explain later what he was doing where he couldn't have his Apple Watch. Anyway, if I'm bored, what do you think I do? I walk, of course. I had the small area to exercise, so I started doing laps of like 0.15 miles one way. I got the idea to wear both his watch and mine and do the same workout on both of them. I wanted to do this experiment because Steve usually gets far fewer calories burned than me when we do the same exercise. This has always made me believe that I must be in far worse shape than him if I burned more calories for the same exercise. Well, guess what? In a walk where my watch clocked 1.06 miles and his said 1.07 miles, my watch showed I burned 80 active calories and his said only 64. So for the exact same exercise, my watch clocks 25% more calories. I should mention that I kept an eye on the heart rate and it looked pretty close, usually a smidge over 100 beats per minute. When we looked at the metrics on the Apple Watch app on the iPhone, his watch showed an average heart rate of 99 beats per minute. Mine showed 109. That's 10% faster on my watch than his, which is kind of weird. Well, after we got back from the trip, we both ran the latest watchOS update and I ran another test. He thought maybe something would have changed on this. At least with a reboot of his phone, maybe it would be different. So, wearing both watches, I walked for 36 minutes, doing kind of a hill walk of about 1.6 miles. On my watch, it said 133 active calories when I was done, and Steve said 184. So that's 38% more calories on Steve's, where before it was 25% fewer. Anyway, the average heart rate was close, 105 beats per minute on mine and 100 on his, so that was closer. I have no explanation for these differences. Steve and I actually weigh almost exactly the same, so that isn't a difference. Maybe somebody else has an idea why there's such a huge difference in the active calories for the same workout and why it changes so much between the two. I mean, that's a wide swing that it's doing. Oh, one other thing. His watch, my watch said it was 64 degrees Fahrenheit out. His said 63, and they actually had different humidity as well. So go figure. Well, even though we had our most awesome Project Fi card for data, we didn't want to spend money unnecessarily. So we were more than willing to jump on free Wi-Fi wherever we could find it at hotels, restaurants, and coffee shops. We were very comforted by the fact that we have an unlimited plan with Cloak for their VPN service. That's at getcloak.com. We pay them, I think you pay $10 a month. We do $92 a year, and that covers all of our devices. That means Steve's Mac, my iPhone, Steve's iPhone, all that traffic was all hidden in our secure tunnel. I know there's been a lot of talk about VPNs, and we may mention a little bit more here, but it was good to know that Cloak was always there for us, and it worked really, really well. There was one funny side effect. While we were in Cusco, Peru, the VPN server Cloak chose by default must have been in Poland because Google was in Polish. Cloak does allow you to choose whether to have them use the closest server or choose one in a specific location, but we still thought that was entertaining. Several times during this story, I've said, I'll explain that later. Like, why was Steve somewhere where he couldn't use his Apple Watch? And why was it so critical that Project Fi came with a phone number along with that data? Well, here's the sad tale. When we were at the Cusco airport waiting to board our flight back to Lima and then on to the United States, someone stole Steve's backpack from right next to him. In it was every piece of electronics he had brought on the trip. A 2013 MacBook Air, luckily we did not bring our new MacBook Pros, had his GoPro Hero 5 and his GoPro Hero 3. We brought two GoPros because that allowed me to take underwater photos while he took underwater videos while snorkeling. It had his Kindle and the camcorder he uses to record our interviews at trade shows. The sadder part of the story? That he also had his passport in the backpack as well. I'm not going to go through all the trials and tribulations we went through to get him a new passport, but let's say we got two bonus days in Lima working with the U.S. Embassy and the Peruvian Immigration Services. But let's talk the tech angle through. When we got our passports, I took photos of both of them and put them in a shared one password note. That meant when his got stolen, we were able to print a copy of the passport to take to the embassy. I suggest you do the same because I think it really helped. Remember I said Steve didn't have his watch on at one point? Well, that's because the U.S. Embassy didn't allow him to take any electronics inside. They made him leave his phone and his watch with me, which is why I had the opportunity to do laps back and forth in front of the embassy. I gotta say, though, the guard was super cool and fun. He was bored and willing to chat at one point, so I showed him my laps on my watch, and he wanted to know all about the watch and how much it costs, so that was fun. The other critical piece of tech was the Project Fi card. Remember that we got two cards, one with just data and one with data and cell service. We kept the cell service card in Steve's phone, and luckily it was the only piece of tech electronics that was not in his backpack at the time it was stolen. Having a phone that we could use for actual calls at 20 cents per minute was critical to our success. For example, we had to move our flights out by 2 days, and for some reason the hotel phone operator could not connect to the 800 number for American Airlines. Using the Project Fi card in our iPhone was the only way we were able to succeed with that task. We also use Facebook Messenger quite a bit. Nick, our fearless tour guide, friended us up on Facebook as soon as he decided he liked us. So we texted him immediately through Messenger when we found out that his backpack was stolen. He was able to contact the local tour agency so they knew that when we arrived in Lima a few hours later, we would need a lot of support. To talk to the tour agency, though, they suggested using WhatsApp. I was a bit concerned about how well this would work. Steve had a WhatsApp account associated with his normal AT&T phone number. I opened up WhatsApp and it said, well, wait a minute, I'm not seeing the SIM card I'm used to. What number did you want to use? Luckily, I'd put the Project Fi phone number into our contacts, so I was able to find it and type it in. I suppose the phone might have told me the number, but I had it already in one area in my contacts, so I could enter it quickly. As soon as we did that, WhatsApp was ready to go. It just said, okay, new number. It didn't seem to mind a bit. Steve used WhatsApp to coordinate with the local tour company who arranged reliable transportation to the embassy and immigration throughout the day. So, WhatsApp for the win. As things were progressing on the passport side, Steve started thinking about what danger he might be in from having the laptop stolen. He had a password on the Mac, but not a great one, but he'd also turned on File Vault. Some services keep you auto-logged in, though, like Facebook and Google and all of your email accounts. Just in case they hacked past the password, he decided to change the passwords for those accounts. Now, here's the bad news. If you have two-factor authentication turned on, the code they send you goes to your cell phone number. But we don't have those SIM cards set up for international calls. The good news, if you can call it that, is that Steve didn't have two-factor authentication set up on most of his accounts, but he did have the NoSilicast Gmail account turned on, which I set up, so it did have two-factor authentication. We simply did without connectivity to that account for a few days. In any case, if you travel internationally, it might be a good plan to have a backup method of getting your two-factor authentication codes with something that will work on travel. I had thought that the recovery email address would have helped me, but it turns out, at least with Google, that doesn't do anything on two-factor authentication. We always buy travel insurance, and the plan we bought from Alliance had $2,000 worth of coverage for lost or stolen luggage, so figure we would be okay. It wouldn't pay for everything he lost, but it would get close. Well, Steve contacted them, and guess what? Electronics and jewelry are capped at $500. I actually think that's pretty sneaky and deceitful. I mean, how the heck do you get to $2,000 if not with jewelry and electronics? I mean, how many shoes can you carry? Well, by this point in our story, I'm sure every single No Sella Castaway is yelling into the devices, "But did you lose your photos and videos, Steve?" Well, you'd be glad to know that before we left the last hotel, he backed up all of our GoPro photos and videos to an external backup SSD I had brought along for that purpose, and we were smart enough to put the backup drive in my backpack, separating it from his photos. I had a copy of my photos on my Mac, and I had the memory card my Olympus camera still had copies of them, so I popped that card out and put it in Steve's backpack. He didn't use the camcorder very much. In fact, it was so little we don't even remember what he did record, so whatever was on that is lost, but we don't even remember what it is, so we can't be sad about it. So the fantastic news is that we did not lose any of our precious photos or videos of one of the most visually amazing trips we've ever been on. Galapagos Island animals and birds are absolutely astounding, and the views of the hike to Machu Picchu were glorious. If we had to choose between having the photos and videos and having the electronics or the money, we would definitely choose the memories. So if I'm to give you any advice out of all of this, it's to bring your tech along for the fun, keep your bag where you're looking directly at it, maybe wrap the handle around your leg, and back up the data you care about. Looking back, this could have happened in any airport, in any location along the trip, including inside the United States, so we should have been backing up every night and separating our backups along the way. How easy would it have been to drop one of the cameras overboard on any one of those trips? Bottom line, though, nobody got hurt, nobody died, it was only stuff that we lost, and it was a fantastic trip. Raleigh Bernard is a friend of Steve and mine. In fact, he's the guy who talked us into going on the India trip with him and his awesome wife, Carolyn, and our friends Wally and Wendy Chirinsky and Donna Barbara McAllister. Raleigh and Carolyn travel more than anybody I've ever met. They go on like 4 huge trips a year. They're our spiritual guides in all things travel. We even called them to find out what shoes to wear in the Galapagos Islands. They told us to get Keens, and it was really, really good advice. Anyway, if the idea of using Project 5 for international data sounds too hard, Raleigh is here with a quick maps tip to help you conserve data and you get turn-by-turn directions while traveling.
Hello, this is Raleigh Barnard. I'm here to talk about foreign travel, specifically how to have data access and remain connected without breaking the bank. In the USA, for example, you can buy international data roaming packages from the cell providers. For example, Verizon has a 100 megabyte package over 30 days for $25, or a 250 megabyte package for $50. Overages, even if it's just for 1 megabyte, cost you $25 for the whole next 100 megabytes. So the problem to be solved is to find the most economical way to do your data roaming. Clearly, the best way is to use the hotel's Wi-Fi. The one caution here is to make sure that you turn off Wi-Fi Assist. This is an insidious feature that you will use cellular data if the Wi-Fi signal isn't strong enough. You won't know this has happened until you get an overage message, though. Okay, what about on the road? There's a great app called City Maps to Go. It doesn't require internet connectivity because it just uses the iPhone's GPS. You can download maps for just about anywhere in whatever detail you need. The catch is it doesn't provide you with turn-by-turn directions to get you from point A to point B, though. Of course, there's also MotionX GPS, which is very full-featured. But here's a neat trick that you can use with Apple Maps. Neat trick. Sounds a bit like spam from email. If you want to plot a route with turn-by-turn directions, you select the start and end points in Apple Maps. While data roaming is turned on, let the maps calculate the route. Then you can turn off data roaming, but Siri will keep informing you of the next turn to make. The catch is, if you deviate from the stored route, Siri quits directing you, but the original route should still be there, you just don't get any help. You'd need to turn on data roaming momentarily to get the recalculation done. I haven't tried this with Google Maps, but this trick may work there also. So that's my neat trick for your edification and amazement.
Well, thanks so much, Raleigh. I just noticed I've been mispronouncing your name all this time. It's Raleigh Barnard. Anyway, Raleigh, that's an excellent tip, and I had no idea if that could even be done.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
How do I? What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Our dumb question this week comes from Kurt. He nearly violated one of my cardinal rules in his question, but I've decided to allow it. Here's what he wrote. Hi, Allison. This dumb question gets dangerously close to the red line of no iTunes questions. I thought I'd ask it anyway. I'd like to be able to archive podcasts on a dedicated media drive. I currently do this manually, copying them out of the appropriate iTunes directory once or twice a year to the media drive and deleting them from the original directory. I always worry that going behind the back of iTunes like this is going to mess something up. In an ideal world, a folder action or an automator script would just watch a certain podcast directory and copy the files to the media drive automatically every time that iTunes downloads one. Then I could set iTunes to delete podcasts after they've been listened to, and I'd have the best of both worlds, a lightweight, trim iTunes folder and archive backups of podcasts. However, I've never really grokked Apple automation methods. Or do you have any other ideas? The goal is to free up space from the gigabytes of podcasts that accumulate in my home folder on an SSD while retaining the ability to occasionally go back and listen to an older podcast without downloading. Cheers. Thanks for the entertaining weekly dose of tech. Well, first of all, Kurt, you're not in any danger of irritating the Mac if you delete podcasts manually from the Finder. I've been doing that for ages. Deleting the folder structure itself might be problematic, but you're not doing that, so you should be fine. I have an automatorless option that's exactly what you want. The easy way to do this is with the tool Hazel from Noodlesoft at noodlesoft.com. Hazel is a system preference pane that lets you point it at folders and then have it make decisions on what happens to the files within. For example, I create giant files every week for the podcast. A typical raw chit-chat across the pond file is 1.5 gigabytes, and then it gets replicated at least once in the process of creating the podcast. I have Hazel watch my creation folder, and when the files are 15 days old, it moves them off to my Drobo for long-term backup. Now, moving means not a copy, but the original is actually gone from my hard disk. For something simple like the process you need, Hazel is pretty easy to figure out. You start by pointing Hazel at a folder. In this case, it would be the folder where iTunes plops your podcasts. Maybe there's some podcasts you want to keep, you know, like mine. You probably won't keep those forever on your disk, and then some you don't. Or so you could make a set of rules for each podcast, or you could watch the whole podcast directory. Let's assume you want all podcasts preserved. You add that folder to the left pane, and then on the right pane, you tap the plus button to add a rule. You give the rule a name, say archive podcast, for example. Then you set conditions for the action. In my example, there's some files I don't want to mess with. I don't want them moved. So I added conditions to exclude them. Then I added a condition for date created is not in the last 15 days. Once you've set up the conditions, you tell Hazel what to do with the files that meet those conditions. This is where you can choose to move the files that meet the conditions and specify the media drive as the location. I looked to see if maybe it could work off of iTunes Play account, but I didn't find one. But you said you were going to just have it move them as soon as they got there. And that'll work. Actually, I guess you would want to have it copy in your case. And then if you're going to have iTunes do the deleting, that'd probably be the way to do it. Anyway, you do need to tell it to copy the file to the media drive, and then, of course, you want to test what you've built before declaring victory. One mistake I make every time is setting the Boolean on the conditions. So if there's some things you want to exclude, you want to make sure that you get your ands and ors correctly, because there's all of the following conditions, but there's also any. And if you have it set to any, you might get some cases where things are not going to do what you want. So anyway, mess around with that and make sure you get that correct. There's also none, so you can set the inverse conditions, like you can say such and such is not happening. Hazel is $32, but it does so many cool things, I think it's worth every penny. Remember the old days when $30 was the cheap app? That's the way you got to look at it. This is a utility that does a lot of really cool stuff, and it's super useful. For example, you can use it to look inside files and rename them based on what it finds inside the files and then take action. I scan in my bills and then Hazel renames the files to match the gas company, phone company, whatever the name is it finds inside. And it adds the invoice date of the bill to the file name, and then it moves it all to my Drobo. It's wicked cool, but you know, that's kind of an advanced course. If you do need the advanced course on Hazel, I learned everything I know about it from David Spark's Hazel Video Field Guide over at maxsparky.com. It's about 2 hours of content, but he walks you through every single step with his usual good humor and fun instruction style. That'll cost you another $20, but it made all the difference in the world in my understanding of the tool. Just last week, I was wondering out loud to Steve about why Bart does so much work for us, and I was kind of speculating on what he gets out of it. Then I heard him do security bits last week without me, and I got to tell you, I was pleased to hear him talk about my contributions to it, because I always think it's all him. And he said that he prefers me to be here to ask questions. I'm sure he's glad he likes that. I feel like I'm the lucky one to have him, and I guess we all are the lucky ones to have him. Well, because of his non-serious illness, the tables are actually turned, and I'm going to do security bits without Bart. Now, I've read his story lineup, and I've discussed the implications of the stories with him, so here goes my very first solo security bits. I know it won't be the same, but I'm going to do my very best. All right, first we got a couple of follow-up stories. WikiLeaks has released code that could unmask CIA hacking operations. This is code named Marble. The articles in Ars Technica and Naked Security explain that this could actually compromise their operations in a way that they won't be able to do the same work they were doing, and they're going to have to spend a lot of time and energy rebuilding their tools and the way they do it. Now, I guess that could be good or bad depending on your perspective on the CIA, so we'll just leave it at that. WikiLeaks also released documents relating to a set of hacking tools the CIA uses to hack Windows PCs and bypass countermeasures like antivirus when doing so. This was codenamed Grasshopper. The Ars Technica article explains that these documents are basically like a how to attack Windows manual. Now, they don't give the source code of all the tools they have, but rather they give the process to follow. Now, pieces of this were out in the internet before, but now there's just sort of a step-by-step guide on how to attack Windows, and that's not a good thing for anybody. All right, a couple of important security updates. Hot on the heels of iOS 10.3, Apple has released iOS 10.3.1, which provides just a single security patch, but a vitally important one. It turns out a flaw has been discovered in the firmware shipped with Broadcom Wi-Fi chips that are used in the iPhone, which allows the phone to be hacked over Wi-Fi unless you do the update to 10.3.1. Now, after the release of 10.3.1, Apple issued a warning that there was a bug in the update. I hate when that happens, which could sometimes re-enable some iCloud services that you had previously disabled. They suggested customers check that they're not using more services than they want to. And there's an iMore article in the show notes showing you where that is. It turns out, though, Apple's not the only vendor selling phones with the Broadcom Wi-Fi chips with that vulnerable firmware. Many Android devices use them, too. While Google has released a patch, as usual, that update's not making it to many, many, many phones that really need it. You know, in case you've ever been in doubt about whether keeping your phone and computers patched is a good idea, I think these last couple of stories Bart gave us would be enough to convince you. In important security news, Apple has released an update to their security white paper. That's a document that describes the security and privacy architecture protecting Apple products and users. TechCrunch has a nice summary of the changes, and I think this is a really cool thing that Apple does, that you know exactly how they're securing your privacy and how important it is to them because they have this level of transparency. Security researchers demonstrated a powerful attack that will work against many smart TVs, and it doesn't require physical access. Instead, the attack only requires the attackers to transmit over-the-air TV signals towards the TV, and it depends on that fairly good assumption that most smart TVs contain old and outdated open source software with known bugs. Now, all software has bugs, but because it's open source, it's a little bit easier for them to find them. The proof of concept was demonstrated against a fully patched Samsung TV, but this problem is not limited to Samsung TVs. Now, I don't know about you guys, but as we've talked about before, having TVs that we only replace every 8 to 10 years, letting them have sophisticated internet access sure is proving out to be a bad idea. Personally, I've turned off or never enabled my TVs to have internet access. With updatable and somewhat disposable boxes like Apple TV, Roku, Chromecast, and Fire TV sticks, there's really no reason to depend on the TV manufacturers to be good at this, and I think they're proven that they're not. Let's see. Security researchers examined Tizen, Samsung's custom OS they use to power a broad range of their Internet of Things products. The security researchers were horrified by what they found. Here's some choice quotes from the researchers. Quote, it may be the worst code I've ever seen, unquote, and quote, everything you can do wrong there, they do it, unquote. So yeah, maybe you don't want to pick up IoT devices from Samsung. And what's wrong with Samsung? Seriously, come on, get your act together. Sophos are reporting that AK Builder malware is succeeding in compromising computers via RTF files, that's rich text format files, and out-of-date versions of Microsoft Word. As always, be sure you're running a supported version of Microsoft Office and keep it fully patched. Turns out the AK Builder malware is being exploited only against Windows versions of Office, but I tracked down the Microsoft Security Bulletin, which patched the vulnerability that's being exploited, and that bulletin applies to Office for the Mac as well. So basically, if you're running Office 2007 or higher for Windows, or Office 2011 or higher for Mac, you should have patched this last October when the patch came out. So if you haven't, get on it. Do not use the facial recognition lock feature on the new Samsung Galaxy S8. It's so poor it can be tricked by taking a photo of the phone's owner and displaying it on a smartphone and waving that in front of the supposedly locked phone. Come on. Seriously? I'm going to say it again. What's wrong with Samsung? I can't believe anybody buys anything from them with all the mistakes they make. You know how I feel about Samsung, but every one of these articles, it is never that Samsung did something great, is it? Well, the Mac Observer warns that Find My Mac can be disabled by resetting the PRAM, also known as NVRAM, on a Mac. They suggest setting a firmware password to prevent any hypothetical thieves from resetting the PRAM/NVRAM. Now, there is an editorial here by Bart. He said, and I quote, I took great umbrage at their chosen headline. It tricked me into thinking that Find My Mac could be used to hack my Mac, so I consider it misleading and over the top. The author disagrees. So I went over and I read the title, and I think the title's over the top, too. I agree with him. I think the title of the article is very alarming. It makes it sound like Back to My Mac is dangerous to use. The point of the very well-written article is that it may be possible to undo Back to My Mac so your Mac can't be tracked if stolen, which is a whole nother problem from the way the title describes it. Security researchers have found a new family of malware that they're naming BrickBot. It successfully permanently bricks poorly designed, poorly secured IoT devices. Time for another editorial by Bart. A good reminder that IoT is still in its Wild West phase. There's an application called Little Flocker. It's designed to watch your file system to see if someone's trying to encrypt it for ransom. You know about Little Snitch? It's the application that watches your network traffic. This is watching your file level structure. So it's sort of like a little snitch for your files. It's called Little Flocker. Anyway, the reason I'm bringing it up is because author Jonathan Zdarsky's, who the author of Little Flocker, was hired by Apple, and now he's sold it off to F-Secure. I do want to give my little editorial here. Friend of the show, Denise, installed Little Flocker in two Macs, and she's been having a devil of a time trying to get it off. She's a really, really sophisticated user, and even with some help from, I think it was David Bender, I hope I'm getting that right, in our Facebook group, who gave her a bunch of super, super nerdy steps she could follow to try to get it off, she still can't get rid of it. She even wrote to F-Secure and asked for a refund, and she basically got a snotty answer of no. So I'm not too excited about Little Flocker myself. In notable breaches, we only have one article. That's amazing. GameStop.com is investigating a possible breach, and there's an article from Krebs on Security about that. Under suggested reading, the first one is really cool. It's called VPNs are for most people, including you, and it's from thewirecutter.com. If you're not familiar with the Wirecutter, they do extensive testing of products and I guess software too. And they tell you what the best one is. They make it real easy to just go, oh, what's the best camcorder? This one. Okay, good. That's one I'm going to go buy. They don't give you, they tell you why and everything, and they give you a more expensive and less expensive option, but they do a really good job of consolidating it. So I think this VPN article is probably really good. The good news is there are a lot of really good VPNs out there. Bad news is there's an awful lot of choice, but luckily, we have a lot of good choices. Let's see. Olson suggested reading the state of Minnesota is pushing back against allowing ISPs to sell their users' data. I know we've talked about that on the show. Bart talked about that extensively last week, and it's kind of neat to see the, one of the states pushing back. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that U.S. President Trump is considering requiring foreigners entering the U.S. to hand over mobile phone contact lists, social media passwords, financial records, and ideology. So we have an editorial by Bart on that. He said, if true, this is a horrifying police state stuff and would mean I never visit the U.S. again. So let's hope the Wall Street Journal got it wrong or the president reconsiders. An article at Naked Security about that. Let's see. There's a bill that would block warrantless searches of Americans' phone at the borders. That's in work right now. Researchers find China tried infiltrating companies lobbying Trump on trade. That should be interesting. And let's see, found quite possibly the most sophisticated Android espionage app ever. Well, that'll keep you up at night. Anyway, Bart closed it out with a palate cleanser, and this is a great one. CGP Grey's humorously informative video explaining the complex process of how YouTube ads work. If you haven't ever seen CGP Grey, you absolutely need to go over to YouTube, drop everything, and watch everything he's ever done. There's maybe two of his videos that didn't just like amaze me. Everything he does is fantastic. I'm subscribed to very few content creators on YouTube, but CGP Grey is definitely one of the few that I am subscribed to. And this was an awesome explanation of the complexities of YouTube and their advertising, I should say. Well, believe it or not, I have made it through my first solo episode of Security Bits. I hope I don't have to do that often, and I hope I did a good enough job to keep you informed. Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. You can follow me on Twitter @podfeet. Remember, everything good starts with podfeet.com. Podfeet.com/Patreon. Podfeet.com/Facebook. Podfeet.com/Google+. Podfeet.com/Amazon for the Amazon affiliate links. And if you want to join in the fun of the live show like Nick from Peru did, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.